Chapter 20. While on our brief Christmas break, which was filled with more work than a break should be, I had a meeting with Chotek. "Hello, Hans, what's up?" I asked as I walked into his temporary office at Club Skippy. "Takahashi thinks the negotiating team should include a military liaison," he explained. The ambassador from Japan was the lead negotiator. Technically, Chotek was an advisor. Maybe the UN had not entirely forgiven him for planning and sparking an alien civil war. "Good idea," I agreed. Then I realized he was looking at me expectantly. "Wait. Not you," he assured me with a wry smile. "The UN wants you as far away from the negotiations as possible." "Probably a good idea, yeah. Takahashi wants you to suggest a list of candidates. Give us 5 Emily Perkins. If you need 5 names on the list," I shrugged. "I'll write Emily Perkins 5 times." "You're that certain?" "I'm certain she is exactly who you need when you're dealing with aliens we can't trust. That includes the beetles and the hamsters. I understand the Ruha do not trust her." "Yeah," I snorted. "She called them on their bullshit too many times. Screw them. Listen, Hans, the hamsters are basically good people, but they have been fighting this damned war for a long time, and they are all about taking care of themselves first. Over the years, they have gotten burned in alliances, so they tend to be transactional in dealings with other species. If they do something for us, they sure as hell will keep the receipt and expect to get something back at least as valuable. Don't ever forget that." "I'm a diplomat, Joe. Every agreement is transactional." "You think having Perkins on the negotiation team won't be a problem when we're talking with the Ruha? We could leave her name off the roster, for I think she should be sitting at the table next to you, especially when you're talking with the Ruha. That will tell them that we remember all the shit that happened since Columbus Day, good and bad. If they want to deal with us, they need to own what they've done and haven't done. With the Giraffe, same thing for a different reason. The Beatles have always been straight with us, and they're looking for a comprehensive long-term alliance. The problem with the Beatles is not that they're not trustworthy. They are basically a bunch of wise guys, but they have a set of rules they stick to. Those rules may seem effed up to us, and the Beatles are flexible about how they interpret their own rules, but whatever. You can write some mechanisms for monitoring and enforcement into the agreements, right? The complication with the Giraffe is they don't really take us seriously." Hans leaned back in his chair, hands folded across his chest, considering. "How so?" "They view us as the dumb kids who got lucky. Partly they're right about that." I shrugged again. "Without Skippy, we would be slaves of the lizards, or extinct. Except," I held up an index finger, "Perkins has run rings around the Beatles without help from a magic beer can. Her sitting at the table will remind the Giraffe that humans are not just the weird aliens who invented fantasy sports. We are not Skippy's cute little pets, you know?" "Interesting. Hey, don't take my word for it. Ask Perkins herself. Negotiations require a team approach. Her record indicates she is not a team player. Not if the team is doing something stupid, no. Hans, if you just want someone to advise about military issues, then pick some random major from the G2 staff. If you want an asset, someone who understands how aliens think and can tell you when the other side is playing games, you want Perkins." He was unconvinced. "General Ross stated she can be dangerous. Rifles are dangerous. You want to get them pointed at the other guy instead of at yourself, you know? Like I said, she's an asset. If Takahashi is nervous, remind him that while Perkins is with your team, she is not off cooking up plans on her own." Emily Perkins raised a hand to knock on the flimsy door, then stopped to check her uniform. It was clean, yet she had walked around a field where dropships were performing vertical touch-and-go landings, so she wasn't surprised to see bits of grass and dried leaves stuck in her pocket flaps, and very likely in her hair also. The condition of the airfield had been improved by recent rains. At least the area was not coated with a fine film of dust thrown up by the turbines of aircraft and dropships. For a moment, she debated ducking into a bathroom to inspect her hair, then decided against it. The latrines were in another building, and she was busy, the meeting with Ambassador Chotek had been squeezed into her schedule. As she knocked, she was surprised that the door swung open. It hadn't been latched. She was also surprised to be walking directly into the ambassador's cramped office rather than having to introduce herself to an aide who controlled access to Chotek. "Colonel Perkins," Chotek closed his laptop. "Come in, please. Sit down." He pointed to the only other chair, set at an awkward angle due to the odd shape of the room. They made small talk for a minute. Then Chotek rested his elbows on the desk, leaning slightly toward her. "General Bishop told you why you're here?" "Yes. He also said I should trust your judgment because he does." At that, the ambassador lifted an eyebrow. "In the beginning, we had a difficult relationship. It has evolved into what I hope is mutual respect." "You still think he is reckless?" "I think he has an instinct to be reckless, and that he has grown into the job, as you Americans would say." She pursed her lips, considering her next question. "Why do you want me as a military advisor?"
"I want to win."
She raised an eyebrow.
"Because you enjoy playing power politics?"
"Because we will not be nibbling around the edges of a deal to trade lumber or some mundane commercial matter. Our talks with the Jarraptha will lay the foundation of our future status in the galaxy to strengthen our position for negotiations with the senior species. The stakes in those talks will be the survival of humanity. We must win. The alternative is unthinkable."
She nodded. "That was the right answer."
"We need to remind our potential allies that this is about winning. That's the difference."
He leaned away just a bit, uncertain.
"The difference? In what way?"
"Client species like the Jarraptha have the possibility of winning now. This war has been endless because no one ever gets to truly win. No one can gain a long-term advantage that threatens the balance of power between the coalitions."
"I understand your point. However, it is our understanding that the Jarraptha have gradually expanded their power and territory over the millennia."
"Yes, only within the Rindaloo Coalition. The Spiders have allowed the Jarraptha to increase their influence as they became more useful, but it's a zero-sum game. The territory, economic, and military power of the Coalition overall has hardly changed. The Rindaloo know there is a limit to how far they can push their enemy before the Maxulks feel their position is threatened and strike back with elder weapons. The Jarraptha know that if we succeed in becoming a third senior power, they might no longer have to fight at the whim of the Rindaloo for the benefit of the Rindaloo. Clients will be free to pursue their own goals. That," she grimaced, "will make the situation in the galaxy more chaotic in the short term."
"Like when the Cold War ended on Earth?"
She held out a hand and wiggled it side to side.
"Somewhat. It's not a perfect analogy because there will be three superpowers in the galaxy, not just one. Maybe it's more like Europe after World War I, where the empires were breaking up. Each power had to forge alliances."
Chotek bit his lower lip.
"We know how that turned out."
"Not well."
"Or maybe I just suck at analogies," she admitted with a tight grin.
"Let us hope." He flashed a brief smile. "Are you interested in the position on our team? You do have a choice. Ambassador Takahashi made that clear. He doesn't want anyone who is not fully on board."
"I'm in."
He nodded.
"I'm curious. You were the de facto leader of the Alien Legion, yet you would now give that up to sit at a table, discussing tedious details?"
"Yes. If you want to know why, it's because the Legion is stalled until we can make the next step. To do that, we need allies. The Legion can't do anything to stop the cloud from freezing Earth. The pirates and the Navy have given us an opening. We need to seize the opportunity while we can."
He stood up and held out a hand.
"Welcome aboard, Colonel Perkins."
Club Skippy had a new amenity that made it a real club. A golf course. Actually, two golf courses. 18-hole courses with sand traps and water hazards and trees, one to the north and one west of the growing town. The fairways were a little rough. Grass seed brought from Earth was still competing with local plants, and the greens were artificial turf to reduce the work required to maintain them.
Why had scarce resources been devoted to creating not one, but two golf courses? Several reasons. The most important is that Admiral Zhao was an enthusiastic golfer, and his staff wanted something that encouraged him to relax rather than working all day every day. The idea for building the first course actually came from the combat engineers. They had to move a lot of dirt to set up the town and the surrounding bases, and dig trenches and holes for water and sewer lines. So one enterprising U.S. Army captain decided to use the fill dirt productively instead of just dumping it. West of town, there is a flat area dotted with small ponds, and the somewhat spongy ground was not much good for setting up any sort of structures. So a group of the engineers volunteered their few off hours, and the area was graded with the fill dirt used to contour the land around the ponds that became water hazards. Only a handful of very optimistic people had brought golf clubs from Earth, and the fabricators were busy cranking out vitally needed components for warships. But whenever a fabricator ship had to go down for maintenance, it needed to make sample components before being brought back online. There was no reason those samples had to be useless, and golf equipment does not require any of the exotic materials needed by starships. Everyone had to borrow clubs, and broken clubs got recycled back into the fabs. Anyway, Chotek invited me to golf with him the afternoon before Valkyrie was scheduled to depart. I had not touched a golf club in a long time, so before embarrassing myself and wasting everyone's time, I went to the pro shop early that morning. The pro shop was just three shipping containers arranged around a tent in the center. The teaching pro was a British Army sergeant who had me swing a weighted club to get a feel for what I should be doing. The pro was amazed by my swing, really. He put his hands behind his back, balanced on the balls of his feet, and pursed his lips. "Sir, I honestly have never seen a swing like that." I could tell he was impressed. But I took it as a bad sign when he suggested it was time to go over to the driving range and he accidentally ran over my clubs with the golf cart. We stood there awkwardly, looking at the shattered bag of clubs. I said. "Sergeant, I think I'll walk." "You're sure, sir?" The guy looked horribly embarrassed. "Yeah, I walked over to the tent where bags of clubs were lined up. "Grab another set of clubs." Of course, the range was already busy, and because everyone knew me, I felt super self-conscious about swinging a club. I took a couple practice swings to warm up, then started with a 7-iron. The driving range was actually an oval-shaped lake that was about 400 meters long. We hit balls that floated to be recovered later. It was kind of cool, because the splash made it easy to see where the ball landed. The water also made it very obvious when you topped the ball and hit a worm burner, a shot that bounces low across the ground, or in this case, skipping across the water. With the 7-iron, I hit pretty well. Switching to a 3-wood was ugly. When I got to the driver, the ball went left and right, anywhere but straight ahead. Really, it was not my fault. The gravity on that planet is slightly different from Earth, and that threw off my swing mechanics. Yes, the jerks around me were hitting the ball just fine, but clearly, they were cheating somehow. "Ugh, ugh." Skippy's avatar appeared in front of me dressed in ridiculous golf attire, including a beanie or bonnet or tam o' shanter or whatever you call those Scottish caps with the button on top. "Don't try to hit the ball, Joe. Just swing the club. Like this." He swung his little club perfectly, of course, because he is an AI who can adjust his swing a billion times a second, and because he is an avatar swinging a virtual club at a virtual ball. "What?" I glared at him. "You're my swing coach now? You certainly need one." "Thank you, but no." Aware that everyone around me was watching, I took a mighty swing and sent the ball splashing across the water, causing a startled fish to jump.
"The fish fry is not until Friday night, Joe," Skippy snickered.
"Hey, I got something for you, Skippy." I reached into a pocket and pulled out a middle finger, shaking it at him.
"This is you, Joe."
He pantomimed a swing, doing it like a spastic robot dance, jerky stop motion. He mocked me, sticking out his tongue like he was having a seizure. People behind me were laughing. "I do not swing like that," I growled at him, swinging the club through his avatar. "I was being generous," he sighed. "Seriously, I would say you're a doofus, but hey, Skippy, I jammed my Z-phone into the ground, made a perfect backswing with a nice follow-through, and sent the phone soaring far into the lake. Goodbye!
Hey!
A muffled voice protested. The voice was coming from my driver. How are you talking through my freaking golf club? I held the thing away from me.
I set up that particular club with a vibration...
Oh, why am I explaining technical stuff to you? It doesn't matter how. What matters is I can help you to... Taking the club in a baseball grip, I swung hard as I could and released, sending it flying through the air away from the lake. It landed in a pile of brush, far enough away that I couldn't hear him. The other clubs in my bag were blessedly silent. Maybe because I was thinking about him being an asshole instead of thinking about hitting the ball, I settled down and hit some good shots. That afternoon, I played 18 holes with Chotek and two guys from the diplomatic staff. I don't want to brag, but I set the course record. Really, no one had ever shot a 132 on that course. Crap. There was now a plaque in the pro shop with my name and score next to it. Also, later, I borrowed a cart to retrieve the club I had thrown. It worked much better after I ran over it with the cart a couple times. Our stay at Jaguar was short. 5 days after Christmas, we jumped away, this time in formation with the Flying Dutchman. After we went outbound through the wormhole, we pinged a relay station, hoping for good news. There was good news, just not the type I was hoping for. The galaxy was relatively quiet. Unusually quiet. Both coalitions had pulled back into defensive postures. That included clients of the Maxulks ordering their ships to home base, giving up the attempt to cover any star system that might be the next target of the alien Legion. They didn't know that Legion operations had been suspended, and we for sure weren't volunteering that information. It was just rotten luck that the Theran and Eklobakis got the message too late to prevent their attack, although maybe those hateful little MFers would have hit our people there anyway just for fun. From the relay station, I took Valkyrie toward Ragnar Station while Chang flew the Dutchman for a meeting with the Jarraptha. The UN negotiation team was aboard his ship. Officially, I was still optimistic about the spiders and kitties coming to the negotiation table to discuss terms. We now had proven the ability to deal with the cloud on our own, so all we needed the senior species to do was leave us alone. I thought that should be an easy basis to begin broader discussions about our future role in the galaxy, and Chotek agreed. Unofficially, every day we got closer to the deadline without any reply from either of the senior species was making me more anxious. Like, I was beginning to have a very bad feeling about the whole situation. Aboard the flagship of his mighty 98th Fleet, Admiral Tashalo fretted over inconsequential details, sending his staff scurrying this way and that to comply with his orders. The human starship Flying Dutchman had sent a message requesting a meeting, and the home fleet assigned Tashalo the responsibility of escorting the humans to the site where initial discussions would be held. With the Flying Dutchman expected to arrive any minute, Tashalo was anxious about providing proper seating for the alien bipeds and scouring the home fleet for beverages the humans were known to enjoy. Unfortunately, other than something called bourbon, beverages appropriate for such an occasion were extremely difficult to obtain on short notice, and the ship's engineers were not confident they could synthesize suitable replacements. That all added to the Admiral's anxiety. The source of his anxiety was not a diplomatic meeting which, while important, would not see any vital decisions made. The true source of his anxiety was the Ethics and Compliance Office. That clandestine organization had gradually changed from supporting home fleet policy to being in the forefront and driving policy, whether authorized or not. Recent ECO actions had committed the Jarraptha to supporting the humans before Tashalo's people were ready to make a break with their longtime patrons. No one in the Ethics and Compliance Office had any right to speak on behalf of the home fleet, certainly not a mere captain with a reputation for being sketchy, even by ECO standards. As Tashalo watched his staff setting out glasses in the conference room and placing a bottle of tequila on a silver platter, he feared that just by meeting with representatives of the Human United Nations, his people were inviting trouble. More trouble than they were prepared for.